This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Without a destination, which direction do you travel? Without goals, how do you measure success? When your company has no clearly defined position, how do you market to customers? At Innes Majori, we've helped companies discover their unique position for 50 years. We are the nation's leading positioning ad agency. Visit im50th.com and start a conversation with us. That's im50th.com.
If you are offended by potty talk, well, then you might be offended. It's Friday, March 18th, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Yesterday on this show, I talked about Joe Biden talking about war crimes. He said he thought Putin was a war criminal. And today, the big newspapers all covered this in a way that at first surprised me. The New York Times putting on its cover, Biden makes it personal by use of war criminal. The estimable David Sanger writing of Biden, his remarks underscored how personal condemnation has become policy as Mr. Biden and his top aides frame Mr. Putin as a pariah, an indiscriminate killer who should be standing trial at The Hague. Should be, but won't be, as was my case that I made on Thursday. The LA Times big banner headline, U.S. to pursue war crime case. They quote Anthony Blinken, as does the New York Times, saying that they think Putin is a war criminal. And then the LA Times also said those attacks, Putin's attacks, have led the State Department to begin a legal process to document potential war crimes against Russia, noting that any formal accusation would probably be brought before the International Criminal Court at The Hague. An accusation, yes, but the accused, almost certainly not. This use of the phrase war crime, this designation of war crimes or war criminal, it seems to be purely rhetorical. It has no actual effect, no practical effect. A prosecution can't actually be brought. And to the Times' credit, they point out that once you start calling people war criminals, you lose some of your options and maneuverability. So I have to say that the huge banner headline in the LA Times, U.S. to pursue war crime case, which was just used as an inducement to a very fine and serviceable story about all the things that Russia did wrong in the last 24 hours, it doesn't change what I've been saying or thinking, that I don't really understand the point of calling the guy a war criminal. It's not like the entire Western world didn't know that he was committing war crimes, and it's not like you needed to point it out using a legal term that has no actual legal practicality in this matter. Hey, maybe they're smarter than I am. Then again, I hope they're smarter than I am. On the show today, I spiel about Sergei Lavrov and his way of speaking and defending Russia as never having done anything wrong. You won't believe, oh yes you will, who he gives credit to in the West for telling the story straight. But first, you know, I could populate The Gist with all my favorite forms of media, but what I'd like to do is point to movies, TV shows, novels that really say something special, maybe something about the zeitgeist, and Search Party is such a show. Not only do I like the show and think it's funny and admire the actors, but I think it says something. I think it might be the first large-scale attempt to successfully depict a different type of person, generational, but also psychological. The plot of Search Party is Chantal goes missing, and some of her old college, not even friends, but maybe associates, find meaning in searching for Chantal. They are Dory, the main character, played by Alia Shawkat, Portia, Elliot, and Drew. And these are all people who are both above it all, but like I said, desperately searching for meaning in their lives. And over the show's five seasons on HBO and TBS, we go along with them as their search for meaning takes darker and darker turns. The creators of Search Party, Sarah Violet Bliss and Charles Rogers, are on next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Sarah Violet Bliss and Charles Rogers are the co-creators, executive producers, head writers, basically everything of Search Party. You may also know them as Fucking Idiot 2 and 1, respectively, in their 2014 film Fort Tilden. Search Party started out on TBS, flipped to HBO Max, where it can be found available for streaming and binging. I recommend you do so. The reason I wanted to talk to Bliss and Rogers, Rogers and Bliss, is because I think they did something unique. I mean, I love the show, but I think the show acts as a little bit like an act of sociology. Let's talk about it. Guys, thanks so very much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
So here is my big fascination with the show, beyond the humor and the plot. I think in terms of character, you put your finger on something I hadn't seen before. It's not that these characters, your main four characters, we've never seen them in other TV shows or works of art, but we often see them in isolation and reflected against someone who's heroic or someone who the audience is maybe meant to, quote, identify more through. And if we talk about their main traits, I mean, you tell me what you think they are, but I wrote down narcissism, entitlement, and delusion. There's a constellation of other traits around that. It's the first time I really saw or spent a lot of time with a work of art where that was just taken as the de facto way that people navigate through the world. Do you think I'm making too much of a big deal about this?
No, I think that's so true. I don't think I had thought of it necessarily as that, but I do think, you know, it seems like there's two kinds of people when it comes to like who our audience is. It's like people who get the show or people who don't. And I think that
Second part wouldn't be your audience then, would it?
No, it would just be people. We would, you know, the thirst for an audience is insatiable. You know,
yes.
It's not until everyone in the world watches it that I'll be satisfied. So there's soon to be an audience. But I think you either feel like you understand the sensibility and the point of view of the show in the sense that it's saying it's taking for granted that people are equipped enough to self-inspect and have enough self-awareness that they understand that everyone has complexity. And a lot of art doesn't cater to that point of view. And a lot of people don't want to think about things that way.
Yeah, I think that the characters have a certain sort of self-awareness, which is they're pretty aware of their emotions or other people's emotions. So they'll do things like they'll soothe each other or they'll try to buck up each other's spirits. But in terms of actual actions, which I was raised to think are the important things, they almost always come up short. And I would also say oftentimes act quite unethically, even if they're quote-unquote kind about it.
Yeah. I mean, I almost think that they subconsciously are completely aware of everything that they're doing. But like you said, their actions betray that from them. And that's why they're able to hold two things at the same time of being like, oh, I know that this is wrong and therefore I'm going to act this way to make up for the thing that's wrong. You know, like it's not, it's kind of a puzzle. But yeah, I think that they are acting in the way that human behavior tends to unfold in that way.
Well, they do. And let's put a little more meat on the bone for people who haven't seen it. Dory, played by Alia Shawkat, is the main character. She goes through a lot of changes, but the show pretty much starts off as her looking at a poster of a missing girl and saying to herself, I think I know that girl. She does. And then she uses the quest to find that missing girl, quote unquote, missing girl. She uses that quest as a voyage of self-discovery, ropes her other friends into it. An incredibly narcissistic act that they keep telling themselves, is it narcissistic? I don't know if that's reflective of, you know, human nature, as you were saying, Sarah Violet, or if it's reflective of a certain milieu, a certain generation. What do you think?
I think every generation is narcissistic. I think every human being is narcissistic. Everyone is everything, first of all. Like, we exist on every spectrum, whether or not we admit it. But, you know, I think that the qualities that maybe the millennial or even Gen Z generations have is the ability to, the vocabulary handed to them to be able to express the ins and outs of their point of view. And so I think that the show kind of builds off of the amount of awareness that our generation has had about themselves. And ultimately, it's, we live in a public space. Like, America is a performative country. Capitalism, it relies on people declaring, you know, a persona in order to navigate it. And so there's no way to transcend that. And we, you know, we have to admit that that narcissism is intrinsically enmeshed with every other single aspect of our existence. But that the show doesn't damn that, because it's important to just take note and take stock of everything you're made up of. The show is about discovering yourself. You know, it's about someone who starts off in the dark about who they are. And as the show revealed itself to us, as we kept on writing, we realized that it was a story about one person's, like, big quest for self-actualization through the darkest and most extreme and colorful means.
Right. Well, but if season 5 never happened, which is, from what I understand of reading about it, it could have ended with season 4, would you be describing the show that way today?
I think so, but I think that if you haven't seen the show, there's no way to talk about it without a bunch of spoilers.
No, that's fine. I think we should go up until the point of, you know, the last few episodes of the show. Anyway, it's been out since what, 2016, 2017? Come on, we're spoiling things that happened during the Obama administration, people.
Yeah, I mean, so the cliffhanger of the end of season 4 is that she dies, and she ends up having a near-death experience. But this character, Dory, is somebody who starts off like, sort of the wounded victim of her friend group, who are all a bunch of fast-talking, you know, hipsters. And then there's, you know, there's a murder, there's a cover-up, and every season changes genres. And then by the time you get to season 4, she's revealed that she's actually the darkest and most narcissistic of all of her friends, and that was always what was inside of her. So what season 5 was an opportunity to show what it's like to be on the other side of a near-death experience, which, of course, is, like, metaphorically a stand-in of, like, you know, ego death, you know, essentially, because she's gone through all these things, she's gone to the limits, and then she reinvents herself. And it's about being on the other side of reinvention, being on the other side of seeing everything that you're made of and not being able to make peace with it and giving in. And so season 5, I'm glad it happened. We're glad it happened. Like, we're able to, like, finish, you know, we're able to finish off like a 5-act structure that we never knew we were setting out to do.
I also heard, Charles, you say this in an interview, talking about the characters and their narcissism and the traits that they embody. You said that there were a certain set of millennial traits, and you think that the world just caught up to that. In other words, we don't say, oh, that's so millennial. We just say, oh, that's people in the world. Do you think that's just a function of demographics? You know, more millennials became more prominent in society, became adults, became people like you who could author works that show millennials? Or is it something else? Do you think, you know, non-millennials maybe changed?
Well, I think that, like, once you hit 30, it's kind of all the same age after that. So, you know, I think that there's, like, essentially, I feel like when we first made our feature Fort Tilden, it felt like we had all these hot takes about millennials that felt like new and fresh. And now talking about it, it's like, oh, we're just talking about adults. We're just talking about mainstream America at this point. And I think that like the homogenization of all the technology and all the streaming platforms and all the social media, you know, everyone's on Instagram pursuing the same elusive nothing, you know, like, so we're all kind of in the same boat at this point. I think the traits that are specific to millennials serve the greater like system of money making. And now we're all kind of in the same quicksand together.
I think also like for some reason, society is always obsessed with like, what are the kids in their 20s doing? You know, like, yeah. And that becomes whatever it is that they're doing becomes their, you know, thing. And once you sort of graduate from that which is of the now into like adulthood, then it just doesn't, you know, you're not as obsessed with like, who am I going to be? And like, how am I going to express who I am? And you just start kind of getting into the groove of like living. And that, I think that's what that obsession with whatever generation is at whatever time comes from.
But these characters in the show, I guess they started out, how old were they maybe when they started out? Mid-20s?
Yeah, and ended up
yeah, like 25.
About,
like,
20
yeah.
to 30?
Yeah,
so 25 to 30. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't have any of that stuff figured out. Like, they didn't really become what we would call adults, maybe until late in the show, some of them got a corporate gig selling apps or something.
Yeah, definitely. But they all have existed. I mean, God, I mean, I don't want to jump around too much, but like, I've just been thinking about how like the whole world looks the same now. Like every city has the same like hipster Szechuan place. Like everyone's got the same stuff. Everyone's wearing the same things. And, you know, whether or not these characters, you know, already existed in that world, and now the whole world exists in that world. And so everywhere is Brooklyn. And I don't know what I'm saying exactly about millennials, but I do know that the world has also transformed into this like sort of like hyper-capitalistic place that has the same patina and facade everywhere.
So you work with non-millennials, Michael Showalter from Stella or some other, or Wet Hot American Summer, which I know you worked on. He directed a bunch of these, right? And he was your professor. When you check in, and of course, you know, you have family members who are older. To test the thesis, the world has taken on these millennial traits. When you check in with these people of different generations, do they agree with that thesis? Do they say, oh, you're just talking about humans, or you're talking about a certain set of humans that maybe aren't the set that I identify with as humans in America in 2022?
I remember Showalter talking about Charles, and my point of view is always being like, you guys see the world as so like dark and mean, like that everyone is like so you know, there's not, our storytelling was more on the side of trying to tap into like a reality than having like the hero at the center of something that was a little bit more 90s palatable, you know. And I see like millennials, I guess, I think generally, not all of them, but, you know, some millennials like, you know, like our show, and then people of other generations also like our show, but see it in a like, whoa, that's so different. And then there's also like, you know, the people who are like, why would I want to watch someone act this way, you know, like that it's distasteful to them, and they want to see the best version of a character rather than unveiling the you know, what's that phrase, the turn of phrase, the underbelly or whatever. I'm really bad at turn of phrases.
I mean, I think that maybe what it's about is like every generation is wounded, or like everyone is wounded, but then every generation like reacts to that wound differently. And when I think about like Gen X, that, I mean, just to super stereotype, it's like cigarette smoking and being like, no, that sucks. Like, the world sucks. Like, don't sell out. Like, ugh, yuck, dumb. And then, like, our generation is, I guess, more, you know, self-obsessed and also is like, wait, the world started without me. It's not fair. And then I guess when you get to Gen Z, the stereotype is basically like the world should be better and, we're the only people that have the keys to that. Why don't you see that? So I think that like the millennial generation is kind of in between those two points of view. And there's a lot of like internal struggle about like what the, how to center yourself in a narrative that's in between those two points of view.
All right. I'm going to do a little more lightning round random questions that I had since I have you and I wondered. Did you have a talk with John Early after he starred in After Party about being in a different party-themed and named premium cable series?
We sure
there
did.
Are many, many shows with the word party in them today. Let's just that say are, that. There's certainly four somehow, shows with the word party in them.
That are somehow mysteries.
Mysteries.
But how many have main cast members from your show?
They probably all do. And they probably all have like $400 million more dollars than we ever did.
Let go in a second. I want to ask about the characters' names. Dory Seif, Drew Gardner, Elliot Goss, Portia Davenport. Where'd those last names come from?
Well, those are probably the most normal names in the whole world of the show.
yes.
But also clearance issues yeah. make you have to choose like three different options. And so, yeah, I mean, Davenport for Portia Davenport, that's kind of vampy, Love Boaty. It has kind of actress vibes, you know, Goss, Gossip, you know, Drew Gardner. You could get fancy and say that it, that means something more than it does, but it, you know, it just feels right. It feels right for all of them. Mm-hmm. And then Seif is an Arab last name that's pretty common, and it just sounded cute with Dory. It was like Dory Seif. It's a cute name.
What are you guys working on next?
We are in development of a feature film called Monster, which is going to be a horror comedy about a girl who moves to LA and becomes the personal assistant to an A-list actress who may or may not be an actual monster. So it's, you know, it's a real monster movie. And yeah, we've got a script. We're taking it out and casting it, packaging it. But, you know, it'll expand on a lot of the same themes and that, you know, our work always does. So
are you gonna, do you hope to direct that one too?
Yeah, we're gonna direct it.
That's good. Co-directors, co-producers, co-creators. Search Party is the show. It's on HBO Max. It started off on TBS. You don't even need to know that. It's entirely on HBO Max. I do recommend you check it out. It's it really was one of the highlights of my pandemic and so many to choose from. Charles, Sarah Violet, thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Sergey Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, went on TV today and admitted it. He admitted all of it.
Russia is an aggressor. Russia is murdering civilians. Russia is abusing sports and so on and so forth.
Well, the doping thing, that's been pushed down on the most clicked bar on the right. But yeah, I mean, it's true. Thank you. Thank you, Sergey. Now, I got to fear for your safety. Some tips: don't walk in public or eat soup. What? Oh, hold on. I'm being told his full comments there were that CNN is saying overly simplistic things like Russia is the aggressor, we committed war crimes, etc. Lavrov was being genuine, however, when he criticized a popular app among teens.
When they concentrate on TikTok and other resources like this and other platforms, and when they target kids, because TikTok is about young boys and girls, I believe this is an attempt to brainwash them for the rest of their life.
And it has been going on for years now. We all know this. You tick, you talk, you don't stop. Doggy Fresh says it. Color Me Bad says it on the occasions when they wish to sex you up. We don't say this. The color revolutions that are bad says this. Your Kesha, your decadent young woman, she has dollar sign at center of her persona. She is one who wants you to tick, tock, blow speakers up. Is a reference to the head of parliament and your Nancy Pelosi. I do not want to blow the speakers up. She does. We get blamed for all the blowing of the things up. I love the Sergey Lavrov voice. I don't even know if it's that accurate. It's just an Ambien for the soul, really. It's tempting. But of all the remarks, the one that got the most play was this statement about the one Western network that Lavrov does give credit to.
If you take the United States, only Fox News is trying to present some alternative point of view.
The brass at Fox has got to be real proud of that, don't you think? Ingram and Tucker getting the Sergey Lavrov shout out, well, croak out. What's left to say? Oh, maybe just one more impression.
You know what is worse than the TikTok? It is the Minecraft. As major exporter of nickel and iron ore, we do not know how you come up with smacking the wood with a little stick to get the iron ore. Is much more complex, shows the West ignores complexities, except for Tucker, he's good.
Lavrov went on to critique Russia's non-inclusion in an international free speech conference, and he took particular aim at the German tabloid Bild for publishing an article in early February alleging that, get this, Russia was planning a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Unclear what exactly Lavrov's problem was with that Bild article. Of course, I have to admit that I briefly took a nap from the beginning of his answer to the end. Now, the only reason I was able to see this bit of propaganda is that some Americans monitor these things and they pull the cuts and put them on Twitter. Because the interview, the venue was Russia Today, the state sanctioned and more or less owned broadcaster. Now, we all know that RTs do not normally equal endorsements, but in the case of RTs interviewing Sergey Lavrov, they definitely do. In fact, it's a condition of their broadcasting. Overall, to see this propaganda is to realize just how sad the Russian attempt to control the narrative has been. They can censor and punish outlets domestically and have huge forays of flag waving. That works, I guess, to their domestic audience. But in America, their tactics have no purchase. And the only way to be exposed to such lies is a bootleg Twitter feed or also by far the most watched show on cable news. There is that too.
Tucker, that guy, he gets it.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara is The Gist's assistant producer. Joel Patterson is The Gist's senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the foreign minister of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, visit advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, depru, dupru, and thanks for listening. Thank you.